curse. If not for the crushing silence, I never would have caught it. There was one thing about the noise, though. It was distinctive. Perhaps not to everyone, but for somebody in my line of work, there was no mistaking the sound of gently rustled paper. I flagged Deborah down, making sure she'd noticed it too. That noise was important. It told us one thing with absolute clarity. Whoever made it wasn't the monster. Those claws weren't suited to handling something as delicate as paper. Determining which office our telltale sound came from was another matter. All the nearby doors were closed, and not a scrap of light gleamed from beneath a single one. They were probably using magical dark vision to keep their profile as low as possible. From the ease with which Amy produced those potions when needed, I was given to understand it wasn't an especially difficult or taxing spell. Mages were tricky to deal with, much for the same reason as vampires. One never knew entirely what an individual might be capable of. With the right incantation, all our advantages could be rendered useless, so it was important that the enemy never have the chance to cast such a spell. Moving slowly, Deborah pressed her ear to one door after another, finally coming to a stop in front of one designated by the nameplate as Dai Yu Lao's office. Her expression turned serious. She definitely heard something inside. I expected her to try the doorknob, but instead, she ran her fingers delicately along the nearby wall. As she moved them, I saw a faint glow trail the digits. Right, another barrier. Her hand continued all the way to the next office door before she paused and returned to Dai Yu's office. This time, she was visibly tense as she reached out, ready to react in a flash. Her index finger lightly touched the door itself, causing a dark glow to ripple out. It didn't take long to piece it together. She was testing for barriers before trying to burst inside. Assuming the door was locked, she'd need to know the weakest places in the perimeter to break through. Even if it wasn't locked, she risked being trapped in there with a dangerous mage, so knowing the escape routes could be vital to her survival. Between her and Arch, I was starting to see that the most dangerous people around me were the ones who viewed preparation and forethought as vital. Deborah's hand pulled back, angling down and going for the handle. This time, there was nothing gentle about her movement. She grabbed the narrow strip of metal, shoved it down, and forced the door open with a solid push. In what seemed like our first lucky break of the evening, the door opened without resistance. Our killer had forgotten to lock it. That optimism was unfortunately short-lived. From my angle, I could just make out a man waiting inside, hands outstretched and a gleam in his eyes. As fast as my body would move, I grabbed Asha and yanked her back, a reactionary effort to get us clear of the door. My reflexes turned out to be right on the money, too. From the doorway came a sudden blast of fire, an explosion that coated everything outside the door in flames. The wall, the carpet, the ceiling, and, most important of all, the vampire standing directly in the way. 7. It should have been an easy decision. Grab Asha, run from the flames, flames that were absolutely one of the traditional ways to kill a vampire, and try to regroup. Maybe we could stash her far enough away that I'd be able to break the barrier keeping us trapped without putting her at risk. Not the best plan, admittedly, but certainly a fair shot better than trying to confront a mage who had just roasted an ancient, incredibly powerful vampire. Plus, I didn't even have the option of telling Asha to run. If she fled, it would get her away from the mage, but we had no idea where the clawed monster was. Without parahuman protection, sending Asha away might very well be the equivalent of urging her off to her own demise. There was another sticking point as well. I didn't actually think Deborah was dead. Knowing her position and having seen scraps of her power, I couldn't quite swallow the idea that she'd be taken out that easily. If I left her on fire, however, the likelihood of actual death would grow exponentially. And so, despite the instinct screaming at me to flee, I tore off my shirt and sweater vest, literally ripping them in half to get them off my torso, and leapt toward Deborah. Instantly, the heat of the fire seared over my skin, trying to work its way inside my lungs. Habit or not, I stopped taking in air for this part, working to avoid as much damage as possible. To my surprise, while the experience was intense, it wasn't as unbearable as I'd expected. I ignored the smaller fires that had cropped up on the floor and ceiling, smacking Deborah's smoke-covered form with the remains of my outfit, hoping dearly that it would be enough to put out the flames. Unfortunately, this had the unintended consequence of putting me directly in the mage's line of sight. He and I locked eyes briefly, a ripple of shock clouding his expression before new words came tumbling softly out of his mouth. Shit! He was casting something else. Maybe it would be another fire blast, maybe not, but whatever it was, I could presume it wasn't going to be pleasant, especially not for Deborah, who'd already taken a giant fireball head-on. I reached forward through the lingering smoke and flames to try to drag her out of the doorway. While it might be pointless, I could perhaps buy us a few extra minutes. You really don't get the point of having a bodyguard, do you? Deborah's voice came a split second before her hand slammed into my torso, hitting me so hard I could feel my quite durable sternum fracture as I was sent sailing backward through the hall. I flew past Asha, finally stopping when I slammed into a wall, leaving a sizable dent behind. The moment I stopped, I scrambled to my feet. Deborah was already moving, Asha hoisted easily over her shoulder as she sprinted past me. Now that she was in the open air, I could see that while her exposed skin was blistered and burned in several places, her face and wardrobe were virtually untouched. Curious as I was, the mystery was certainly not more important than the figure emerging from within the office, a figure I could just barely make out through the smoke. We needed time to recover. The momentum of the fight had clearly swung against us. I sprinted off after Deborah with no idea where she was heading. It didn't matter at this point. Getting clear and keeping up with my friends was the main goal. We wove our way through the halls at breakneck speed until Deborah ducked into a small room with white tiles on every surface. Lovely. It seemed we'd be hiding in the bathroom, and me without a single bottle of hand sanitizer. Once we were inside, Deborah went to work. She set Asha down, then turned on the faucets, splashing cold water across the burns on her flesh. The wounds were already healing, and the soothing liquid seemed to speed the process along. After checking on Asha, who decided to splash some water on her face for different reasons, I focused on the real question. What happened back there? Fire hurts vampires, and a blast like that should have roasted you. Do we become resistant to it with age? Unlikely though the idea seemed, Deborah's survival made me consider it as slightly possible. Oh, wow, don't I wish... Deborah sent a few drops of water spraying with a shake of her head. No, the true methods impact all of us, regardless of age. Fire, sunlight, silver, decapitation, stakes. From the Blood Council to a vampire made yesterday, they'll kill us just the same. However, that wasn't actual fire, Fred. It was magical fire, created by a spell, and right now... You and I are walking around with magical defense thanks to Phineas's blood. Obviously not as much as I might have liked, but it served its purpose, no? Any explosion you can walk away from is a good one. While that did explain part of it, there was clearly more going on than she had shared. Do your clothes have magical protection, too? In a manner of speaking, back before humans figured out it was toxic to them, they found ways to weave asbestos into all sorts of things, clothing included. It's rudimentary protection, but we kept working on it even after they shied away. I don't think I own a single ensemble that doesn't have asbestos as a component. It's also why I tend to favor long sleeves. You can throw your arms up to protect your face. Deborah demonstrated exactly that, holding her arms like parallel bars in front of her head. Hang on, you put asbestos in all your clothes? Doesn't that seem like overkill? Asha was wiping her neck with a damp paper towel. The sudden influx of heat had affected her more than either of us. Then again, it clearly just worked, so maybe I shouldn't talk shit. Lowering her arms, Deborah nodded. When there are only a few methods to kill you, it becomes easier to take steps against those methods. Learning to fight and sleeping lightly helps avoid stakes as well as beheading. Incorporating defenses into my clothing wards against fire, and high SPF sunscreen will buy me a few extra seconds in sunlight. Silver, well, there's no real defense against that one, so I just steer clear of the stuff whenever possible. Fortunately, that holds true for most other parahumans as well, so it rarely comes into play. I had no response to that, largely because I didn't trust my tongue. When I'd developed a silver immunity, it had come after allowing Gideon to channel tremendous amounts of his power through me as a vessel. Dragon magic was a peculiar thing. It often worked in ways that no one else understood, and, to my knowledge, I was the first vampire to undergo such a process. Still, when even Arch and Crystal had been stumped for an explanation at the change, part of me had held out hope that other vampires might be able to provide some insight. If Deborah, an ancient vampire and member of the Blood Council, hadn't ever heard of such a thing, however, I might never find an explanation. Of course, that assumed Deborah was telling the truth, which would be a silly presumption given the nature of our relationship. She certainly wasn't obligated to reveal any hidden vampire secrets or lore to me. All the same, I kept my mouth shut. If I really was the first vampire to be immune to silver, I didn't want to imagine what length the others of my kind would go to in order to learn how to duplicate such an ability. "Hey, Fred, are you listening?" Deborah's expression was annoyed, verging on worried. I'd momentarily gotten so lost in my thoughts that I'd forgotten to pay attention to what was going on around me. A very bad, dangerous habit, especially in circumstances like these. "Sorry, could you repeat yourself? It's been a long night, you know." "Going to get longer before it's over," Deborah replied. "I was saying that you shouldn't have jumped in to help. I was fine. I took the attack instead of dodging to lure him into a false sense of security. If you hadn't gotten in the way, I was going to charge him when he cast his next spell. That's when a mage is most vulnerable. They can't just shift spells mid-gear, so they either have to try to see it through or give up to fight." Such an idea hadn't even occurred to me, although it should have. Deborah wasn't one of my friends or even an agent. She was powerful enough to be part of an organization feared by all vampires, and not without good reason. "Again, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you had defenses in place, and I wasn't sure you'd be able to put the flames out in time." She studied me as I spoke, no effort made to conceal the expression. I found I was growing accustomed to her constant analytical gaze, even if I didn't expect to ever be fully comfortable with it. "Your heart was in the right place, I suppose. But remember, I am here to guard you, not vice versa. The Blood Council has opened an official assessment on you, Frederick Fletcher, and no one decides whether you live or die until we have ruled. That right belongs solely to us. So stop making my job harder." She gave me another lingering look, this one harder to read, before she turned to Asha. "Do you know which mage that was?" From the gender and skin tone, I'm guessing we didn't just fight Dai Yu Lao. I didn't get a great look before the explosion, but I think I caught enough of the buzz cut to recognize Kevin Crawford, the mage who specializes in animation enchantments, Asha said. He must have built that claw monster we ran into earlier. A sharp sound came from Deborah's throat, almost like a tisk, but deeper. Don't make too many assumptions just yet. I saw the buzz cut, too, and there were no signs of an illusion in place, so we can probably go forward presuming it's him. As for the monster, until we see it up close, we should assume anything is in play. Maybe he summoned it from a nether realm, maybe he built it. Maybe it's a cohort using shape-changing magic. We are at our weakest when we have to react to the unexpected, so make a point of expecting damn near everything. Then what do you expect will happen now? Asha tossed her damp towel into the trash can and turned off the faucet, only for Deborah to reach over and turn it right back on. Now there is no more chance at waiting this out. He knows our numbers, and we should assume he'll realize that two of us are vampires. It's smarter to plan as though we have all possible disadvantages, whether it's true or not. He knows for certain that I was able to withstand a fireball, and that means he's aware we're dangerous. Rather than leave the dirty work to his monster, Kevin will likely be hunting as well, rather than just ransacking offices. He'll almost certainly coordinate with his creation, try to make us deal with multiple threats at once. We'll have to handle them both if we want to walk out of here alive. I pointed to the running water. And how does a faucet influence that plan? In response, Deborah turned on every faucet in the bathroom, then snapped a toilet pipe for good measure, sending water shooting onto the floor. This whole office is too quiet. I don't like having my senses limited, but I'm going to make sure he doesn't have an easy time tracking us. First, we turn on everything we can find. Lights, radios, faucets. If it makes noise or draws attention, get it running. It should help muffle the sounds of our movement. If we're lucky, we might be able to get the drop on him. And if we're not lucky, I countered. Then you might want to get your fangs out, Deborah replied, because we could very easily have a deadly fight on our hands. 8. Generally speaking, I got far less use out of my enhanced senses than most other vampires. For them, the ability to hear panting from streets away, smell sweat trailing on the air, and see through even the darkest of evenings were all essential parts of fighting and hunting. For me, it often just made reading or watching TV into an annoyingly distracting affair. That was why I worked hard to ignore those senses, honing my selective attention the way a warrior would hone their punches. So when our senses had been dampened, before I knew about the threats, I wasn't actually put out at all. And by the time Deborah's plan was fully prepared, I was downright thankful not to have my full hearing. The horrendous pop songs screeching out of every nearby computer and radio we could access was harsh enough with even just a human's level of awareness. That was sort of the point, however. All that annoying noise allowed us to move around more freely, even if Kevin and his monster would eventually still find us. We had intentionally congregated in the loudest spot. Of course, they'd realize it was a trap. This effort was only slightly more subtle than erecting a box barely supported by a twig with a sign that read, "Free Bird Seed" next to it. Complex planning was for those with more options. We were on unfamiliar turf against two enemies we knew virtually nothing about. Winging it was really our only course of action. It didn't take long before Deborah raced silently around the corner, throwing up a hand gesture to indicate she'd seen Kevin coming. As both the fastest and the quietest on their feet, Deborah was the natural choice to take the role of lookout. Based on her signal, there was no sign of the monster, which wasn't ideal, but was roughly what we'd expected. Carefully, Asha slipped into a nearby office, sliding the door closed with as little noise as possible. This was a dangerous encounter, and as a human, her place was not to be in the middle of everything. With her safely tucked away, Deborah and I were alone, waiting for Kevin to arrive, surrounded by clashing pop tunes. "Fred, I think there's something it's important we clarify before this goes down. I don't actually work for you, not directly." Deborah's eyes were bouncing among the possible avenues of attack, ready for an approach from any direction. "Bodyguards do our best to honor the client's wishes, but at the end of the day, their well-being is our only actual job, which is my nice way of saying that while I respect the request for me not to kill our criminal, if it comes down to him or either of us, I'll kill him without hesitation. Really, we could end the whole thing now if you'd just lift that stipulation." "Why is killing him easier than subduing him? It's still a fight either way." Another long assessing look before she replied. "No, it's not the same. Not at all. Subduing requires me to get up close and personal, to put myself at risk. Killing him, well, that's another matter. There are techniques, abilities I have from training and feeding that would snuff him out without a moment's thought. If you really think this is all we're capable of, then you don't understand why vampires are as feared as we are." That was hard to argue with. My knowledge of vampires was limited to what I'd seen from Petra, Quinn, and Lillian. While each was more powerful than me, their power was something I could easily grasp. But from what Deborah had said, it seemed I was a toddler comparing myself with preschoolers, whereas she was an adult. "You're right. There's a tremendous amount about our kind that I don't know, and I'm sure you can do things I've yet to imagine. If you're that powerful, though, then it seems like capturing a simple mage alive would be well within your capabilities." There was a hint of laughter from Deborah, brief and hard to hear over the music. "Don't waste your time going after my ego. I'm long past such barbs. But I will try to go for the capture, because this is your show to run. Just be aware that if push comes to shove, I shove for keeps." Our conversation ended as Kevin rounded the corner, seemingly catching us unaware. Obviously, we'd been waiting for him. The chatter was just one more way to make ourselves seem flat-footed. And no sooner had he stepped into view than a giant red barrier filled the hallway, separating us from him. It moved with him, staying a few feet before him as he made his way forward, small gestures from his hand guiding the wall with each step. "I knew you were trying to bait me, but I didn't expect you to make it this easy." Kevin looked at us more closely, a snicker drifting up from his lips. "You hid that lawyer of Phineas's, I see. Probably someplace far away, in the hopes she'd be safe from me. When this is over, I'll hunt her down as well. And she will pay for that annoyance." Taking the bait, I ran forward and threw a punch at the barrier. It absorbed my blow just as the one blocking the exits had nullified Deborah's. The difference was that mine wasn't nearly as strong, nor especially meant to penetrate. Between the fact that I was running around shirtless and the lucky break that Kevin had never met me, it made sense to take on the appearance of a vampire more in line with common expectations. If he didn't consider us to be the thinking sort, then there was less chance he'd see the surprise coming.
"Pitiful. Just pitiful. Healing from that fire must have taken a lot out of both of you. Maybe you should have eaten the lawyer instead of stowing her. I doubt you'll even make a proper opponent for my red friend."
Kevin laughed, cackled, really, in a way that had absolutely been practiced. On cue, the clawed beast stepped into view at the other side of the hallway. This was our first time getting a good look at it, and what a sight it was to behold. It was like a scorpion version of a centaur, with six dense legs attached to a long, flat body that suddenly shot upward and turned into a human-like torso. Instead of hands, the arms ended in those thick claws, and the face was nothing more than a pair of inky black eyes and a mandible mouth. At the rear was a 4-foot stinger, too short to come into play if someone attacked the monster's front, but long enough to do a perfect job guarding its back.
"I call him Sanderson, named after the intern I used for some of the base components. Phineas never wanted to hear how far our company could really go. He didn't like the idea of using humans as pieces for more lifelike automatons. Forget the sex industry. We could pump out Sandersons and sell them to the highest bidder. There are always people looking to kill without getting their hands dirty."
From his pocket, Kevin produced a small digital camcorder and flipped it on.
"This is perfect, actually. Proving Sanderson can hold his own against 2 vampires will be more than enough to secure me some initial orders. Thanks to the capital I've been skimming and the blackmail material I've got, that should be plenty enough to launch my own enterprise."
"Maybe you shouldn't admit that on tape," Deborah suggested.
"It's my tape, going to my future clients. Something tells me they won't care how the company came into being, and you should really concern yourself with Sanderson more than me."
Kevin paused, looking to the monster.
"Sanderson! Tear them both apart!"
There was no hesitation, not even for an instant. As soon as Kevin spoke, Sanderson complied. His dark eyes turned toward us, no humanity whatsoever as he charged with his claws extended. Whatever, whoever, had gone into this creature, they were long dead. The thing that remained was nothing more than a puppet powered by Kevin's magic. Sanderson was faster than he looked. His 6 legs scuttled rapidly, hauling the bulky body around with unexpected precision. Still, it was a charge from half a hallway's distance against a pair of vampires, so we easily ducked out of the way and then ran around to the other side. We made it 20 feet before another red barrier popped up. Turning back, we could make out Kevin's pinched expression, still protected by his magic wall, scrunched with a look of concentration.
"No more running away. My clients deserve to see a proper show."
There was no need for orders this time. Sanderson was already charging toward us again. As it moved, Kevin slowly followed, shifting his barrier to keep close enough to ensure his device would record all the action. We couldn't pay Kevin too much attention. Sanderson was nearly on top of us, and with the box we were trapped in slowly shrinking, our avoidance options were growing steadily more limited. I dodged a claw meant for my head, infinitely grateful that we'd drunk enough of Phineas's blood to ignore the wards limiting our physical power. Deborah chose a different tactic. The next time a claw came near, she easily stepped out of its way, but rather than let it keep going, Deborah grabbed the arm and jerked hard, pulling the appendage around the creature's back. Its tail tried to stab at her, but she kept jerking just out of range until finally it lingered too long. She stretched out her other hand, lightning quick, and took hold of the stinger.
"Oh no! However will we defeat such a bold and terrifying monster? All is lost! Truly, all is lost!"
Deborah's voice was pure mocking acid as she held on to 2 of Sanderson's offensive options, bringing him down to a single claw and a mouth of mandibles. She locked eyes with Kevin, who was growing visibly frustrated as she mocked his creation on camera.
"Perhaps you're stronger than I thought. That's the best part of using magical automatons, though. They're easy to alter on the fly when one knows the correct spells.
Still safely behind his wall, Kevin lifted the hand not holding a camera and began to whisper under his breath. No doubt about it, he was casting probably something outright offensive or a spell that would supercharge Sanderson. It was a sound tactic. Unfortunately, it was also a very predictable one. Luring Kevin onto our turf had been the first step. It was the only way to ensure he couldn't set traps in advance. Getting him to advance to his current position was the next requirement, which we'd managed by driving the fighting further down the hallway. The last piece was this moment, when he tried to cast. We hadn't known how it would arrive, or what the circumstances would be when it came, but there was no doubt that he'd turn to magic if things didn't go his way. When one had access to magic, the inclination was to use it at every opportunity. Behind Kevin, Asha slipped silently out of the office where she'd been hiding, watching through the barest crack of an opening. She darted forward, metal flashing in her hand. Deborah had said it best. The moment a mage was casting was their most vulnerable, and that was when Asha had to strike. In mere seconds, Asha had arrived, and while I caught a flicker of hesitation in her face, the sentiment didn't reach her arms. They thrust forward, slamming the letter opener we'd pilfered from a desk deep into Kevin's back. A single stab wound wasn't enough to kill most people, especially mages. On the other hand, it was more than enough to shatter their concentration. The barrier in front of Kevin flickered as pain overtook him, and that was all we needed. I didn't actually see Deborah move. The hot spray of ichor from Sanderson's suddenly missing limbs was how I knew she was gone. I soon caught sight of her on top of Kevin, pinning him to the ground with Sanderson's tail. I glanced to my side and found the creature in pieces. Deborah hadn't been gentle in her finishing of the fight. There were chunks of red monster all over the hallway. And me, I soon noticed. It was comforting to know that she could have torn Sanderson apart at any moment, but also somewhat disturbing. How much of tonight had been necessary, and how much did we endure solely because I'd asked Deborah not to go for a kill up front? I tried not to linger on that just yet, as we still had a mage to deal with. However, by the time I jogged over to Deborah, that problem was well in hand. Both of Kevin's hands were broken, and from the swelling around his mouth, it seemed a safe bet that his jaw was fractured too. No words, no gestures, no magic. A brutal method of capturing a mage, but compared to what Deborah had done to Sanderson, it was the very picture of mercy.
"You see, this is why you never record yourself saying something incriminating."
In her hands, Deborah spun the camera around and caught it in the same motion.
"Because your tape isn't guaranteed to stay yours forever. Consider that during your time down whatever hole the agency throws you into."
9. As it turned out, Kevin had not activated the outer barrier. That was a failsafe that kicked on when Phineas died, meaning we were all stuck inside the office until morning. Thankfully, much of the night had already been spent running and hiding, and with no more threats, we were able to wait peacefully until staff began to show up and found their office sealed. Calls went out to the agency, and by mid-morning, the barrier had been safely dispelled. From there, it was a brief whirlwind of activity. Between Asha's statement, the evidence, and the tape, there was no question as to who was at fault for the murder of Phineas and the destruction in the office. Once we'd been thoroughly interviewed, Deborah and I were released. Mercifully, one of the agents backed our vehicle right to the front door, over the sidewalk, so that we could enter under the shade of an overhang. Once inside, we drove carefully back to Charlotte Manor, with promises to meet up with Asha once she was released. As she'd been on the premises longer, she had more to tell, and the agents weren't keen on us sticking around once they'd heard our side of the story. I couldn't really blame them. Having two vampires hanging about was likely unnerving on its own, all the worse when one of them was shirtless and coated in monster guts. I'd done my best to wash off in the sink, but this was a job for at least a shower, possibly a fire hose. The ride was largely silent until we arrived at Charlotte Manor. As I parked beneath the shaded overhang entrance and unbuckled my seatbelt, Deborah spoke up. "I think, after seeing how you handled yourself last night, that it's time for us to have a lesson, Fred." "A lesson?" My curiosity was piqued. Admittedly, I'd always wanted to learn more about vampires, and the prior night had only made me more curious. "What did you have in mind?" "It's better if you don't know. Adapting to surprises is always a good skill to hone. Just don't make any plans for tonight. I know your schedule is open, so keep it that way. I didn't realize just how much you still had to learn. There are some things about you that demand education. Honestly, I'm somewhat shocked you've managed to survive for this long. Your friends must have been picking up a lot of the slack." While that seemed like a needlessly cruel way to phrase it, I couldn't exactly disagree with her point. "They have. I'm not much of a combatant, I know. I've honestly never had the stomach for it. I do my best, I try, but I know it's the people in my life who have gotten us this far." "See, that's the thing, Fred. You're comparatively weak, and you seem to know it, yet you insist on acting like you're strong." Deborah shook her head. "Never mind, we'll go over it later. No sense in doing this by half measures. There are lessons you need, but not with the sun overhead and that stinking goo still on your torso. Let's go rest, get a good meal, and definitely a shower. Be ready for a field trip at sunset." The passenger door opened as Deborah saw herself out, darting inside quickly despite us being protected by the shade. I couldn't fault her for that. Being in the open during the day felt dangerous, like one wrong step could cost us our lives. For someone as careful as Deborah, that level of risk must be unbearable. The more time I spent with Deborah, the more I was growing to fear her. Legends about the Blood Council were one thing. I'd grown accustomed to seeing the humanity behind feared figures like Richard, agents like Crystal or Arch, and even slivers of decency in mythical beings like Gideon. Deborah had that humanity as well, though I didn't find it nearly as comforting. Most parahumans swung their power around as the first and final solution to every problem. Deborah, on the other hand, took nothing for granted. She used her mind more than her raw skills, which made those skills all the more dangerous. If most people's humanity was a doorway to their gentler side, hers was a wall she used to shore up her weaknesses. She'd even said it herself earlier that night. Deborah knew she was mortal, knew she was vulnerable, and took steps to make sure those liabilities wouldn't be used against her. If she decided to kill me, I was growing steadily more confident that there would be no respite. No tricks, no red tape, no angles we could exploit to save me. She wasn't a brute. She would consider and defend against those possibilities. In a way, it was funny. The more time I spent with Deborah, the more human and helpless I felt. Had Crystal been home, I'd have gone up to talk with her. As it was, I found myself wandering the halls of Charlotte Manor, despite my dire need for a shirt and a shower. Part of me wanted to knock on Arch's door to see if he knew more about the Blood Council or had some insight into what I should expect. Ultimately, I chose not to seek him or any of the others out. Not out of fear that they would have no information to share, but rather because every time I went to dial a phone number, I remembered Deborah's words. My friends had been picking up a lot of slack for me. She was right. I'd never been under any delusion that I was an actual threat or force to be reckoned with in any capacity outside an audit. And in the beginning, that had been fine. Things were different now. I was the head of a clan. People were counting on me. The actions I took or failed to take would impact my friends' lives. Deborah had come to assess if I was fit to lead the House of Fred. In truth, I wasn't sure she would or should decide in my favor. But if there was any chance of my making it through this, I needed to be better, to be the kind of person who deserved my friend's trust, who could be counted on when the need was dire. If a lesson from Deborah could get me closer to that, then I owed it to my clan and myself to tackle it head on. After a long shower and a deep mug of blood, I settled into bed. As always, when the sun was overhead, sleep came naturally, momentarily dulling my worries about what the night ahead would bring. A Lesson in the Woods. 1. It was difficult to predict what sort of lesson a teacher like Deborah might impart. Perhaps we would review vampiric lore, allowing me to learn more about our history, our ruling structure, and our abilities. There was also a chance she might throw me into a ring with several therianthropes to see if I could fight my way out. Deborah had said that, as my bodyguard, she wouldn't allow me to be killed, but that protection only lasted until she'd decided whether or not I was fit to lead a vampire clan. If I had disappointed her, there was no reason for her not to let someone tear me apart. With some effort, I shook such thoughts from my head. There was nothing spur-of-the-moment about Deborah. If she decided to kill me, it would be with forethought and deliberate execution. That thought was, strangely, a bit comforting as I dressed for the night. Eschewing my normal loafers, I opted to wear some sneakers that had gotten little use since their purchase. Slacks were replaced with jeans, and a simple long-sleeved shirt took the place of my preferred sweater vest. Mobility and durability. Not features I expected to need, but after all the lessons Deborah had imparted on thinking ahead, I hoped to show that I was paying attention. In a small backpack, I stashed my enchanted flask, topped off with blood, sunscreen, a spare phone charger, and an extra-large umbrella. Having only the words field trip to go on, I'd chosen my supplies with as much attention to their general usefulness as possible. Sealing up the bag, I threw it over my shoulders and headed downstairs. Deborah was already there, clad in an outfit not dissimilar to my own, jeans, boots, and a dark turtleneck with a thick vest on top. No bag, although that vest did look like it had a lot of pockets. She gave me an approving nod as I made my way down the stairs. "I half expected you to show up in your usual sweater vest." "I already lost one last night. I'm not sure what you meant by field trip, but I assumed I'd have to replace another sweater if I didn't adapt my attire accordingly."
"Smart move."
Deborah turned toward the door, nearly bouncing off the old woman version of Charlotte, who was stepping out from behind the counter. The weary eyes swept over the both of us, an odd touch of pageantry, since I knew that Charlotte could see and hear all within her walls. Finally, the old woman's eyes settled on me.
"Would you care for dinner tonight? Arch, Neil, and Albert are all out training, and Lillian has client meetings, so it would be just the two of you. I'd be happy to take requests."
It was tempting. As a rule, I never turned down Charlotte's culinary talents, but Deborah was already shaking her head.
"Much as it pains me to decline, I'm afraid that Fred and I are on a strict schedule tonight, with no time for delays. If all goes well, I expect we'll want quite the breakfast, though."
"I'll be sure to prepare something special," Charlotte replied. Again, the old woman's eyes were on me. and I'll make sure the others know you've stepped out together. If they ask, where should I tell them you went?
No spoilers, Charlotte. Part of tonight's adventure is the unknown.
Deborah reached over and grabbed a piece of paper, scribbling down a few quick words before she folded it in half.
Should anyone need to reach us for some reason,
show them this. Charlotte accepted the page, a slow wave of relief spreading over her face as she read what Deborah had written. I'll do just that.
Good. Now, Fred, I wasn't kidding about the strict timetable for tonight. We need to get moving.
Deborah was out the door before her sentence was fully finished, and I followed, pausing only briefly to throw a grateful glance at Charlotte. It was clear what she'd been trying to do, and I appreciated the concern. There wasn't much discussion after that. An SUV I'd never seen before was waiting outside, and when Deborah slipped into the driver's seat, I noticed that she didn't need to adjust so much as a single mirror. We were on the highway in minutes, only we weren't heading toward Winslow's downtown metropolitan area for a change. Instead, we were going farther out of the city, toward the wilderness and what passed for mountains in our region. Winslow was never a popular ski destination like many other Colorado towns. The terrain was too rocky and the mountaintops too low, but that didn't mean we were without elevation. Deborah drove on those ascending roads for 2 hours, taking us up into the mountains while Winslow fell steadily behind. To my surprise, no destination appeared before us, no landmark I could use to deduce our ultimate location. Even as she began to slow, pulling over onto a modest shoulder meant for resting, I was at a loss as to where we were. There was nothing around. Part of me wondered if perhaps this lesson involved having to navigate our way back to town, or demanded that I finish ascending the mountain on my own. Again, I wasn't sure what lessons I would be expected to take from such experiences, but that's why I was the student, not the teacher. Whatever our destination, we had clearly arrived, and I followed Deborah's lead as she removed her seatbelt.
Okay, now that we're almost ready, tell me what you brought.
Deborah pointed to the backpack resting in my lap, in case I hadn't taken the message from her words alone.
Blood, sunscreen, an umbrella, and an extra charger for my phone.
Not bad. Good variety. Majority of them with multiple uses. Most vampires your age would have only brought the blood, or nothing at all. I have to say, that might be the most interesting feature about you, Fred. New vampires are almost always drunk on their power, certain that no being in the world can best them. The delusion doesn't last long, especially not in proper clans, where a leader can put them in their place. But the ego often persists for a while. You, on the other hand, seem extremely aware of how vulnerable you are. If the majority of vampires lean too much on their undead side in the early years, then you're the opposite, someone who has robed himself in his humanity.
The company I keep helps me retain perspective, I added. It's hard to feel exceptional with people like Crystal, Richard, and Arch in my life.
For a moment, I'd been prepared to list Gideon in that final spot, but at the last minute I veered away. The Blood Council knew I had an alliance with Gideon, but that wasn't quite the same as me talking about him as a casual acquaintance. The more distance I kept between myself and the King of the West in their eyes, the less likely they'd poke around and find out about my unusual condition.
They are all exceptional. However, we vampires are no slouches either.
I think it's time you gained a proper understanding of exactly what it is you are, and what you can do when truly pushed. Like a striking serpent, her hand snapped out and snatched the backpack from my lap before I had time to do more than reflexively twitch. I had no idea what kind of blood Deborah had previously drunk, but it was clearly from something fast.
For this lesson, however, you don't get supplies.
Tools are useful, and I applaud you for thinking ahead. However, the point of this exercise is to see what you can manage on your own. No tools, no tech, no spare blood. Tonight, we're going old school.
My mouth opened to ask what exactly that entailed. Unfortunately, the words never actually passed my lips. In another flash of movement, Deborah's open palm slammed into my sternum, the exact same place she'd hit me the night before. There was a brief sensation of something against my back. In hindsight, I would realize it was the door snapping off the chassis, and then the whistle of the air was there to greet me. I could see the SUV as I hurtled backward. I could make it out atop that highway shoulder, Deborah staring at me intently as I began to plummet and lose sight of her. She hadn't just knocked me out of the car, she'd knocked me off the side of the mountain, too far into the air to even try to grab hold of the steep terrain. Trapped in the open air, with no way to make my way back, I fell, my body crashing at last against a small boulder formation far, far below. 2. Killing a vampire is no easy feat, as I've mentioned. Outside of the specific methods previously described, there's almost no way to bring us down for good. Hurting a vampire, on the other hand, is much more achievable than some might think. We are hardy, yes, yet not so tough that a gunshot, or fall from a mountain, won't cause us injury. The difference is that our bodies are in a state of near-constant repair. So long as we can stay fed, our bodies will eventually heal nearly all damage. That said, I still ached like hell as I finally stirred atop the boulders. Since the attack came at night, I didn't even have the small mercy of passing out from the pain. I had to remain fully conscious as my bones and flesh knit themselves back together. The process was hardly enjoyable, at some points barely tolerable, so I think it forgivable that, in my recovery, I didn't notice Deborah's arrival. All I knew was that, when I finally sat up, she was sitting on a nearby rock formation, waiting patiently.
If the lesson was to never take off my seatbelt until I'm ready to get out of the car, then lesson well learned.
You've still got a sense of humor. That's a surprise. I half expected you to try to tear my throat out for what I just pulled. Although, if you were the type to choose that path, then I suppose we wouldn't really need to do this in the first place.
Deborah was calm, yet taut, like she was ready to spring away at a moment's notice. Despite her words, she clearly wasn't sure that I wouldn't try to attack, and even with our difference in abilities, she wasn't leaving any openings.
How do you feel, by the way?
Sore, obviously.
As I got to my feet, another feeling struck me, so great I almost lost a step. It was a deep, fierce sensation that rose up from the middle of my stomach and stretched out to every nerve in my body.
Also, I'm hungry.
That was an understatement. For a fleeting moment, I felt like I was hunger itself, all my instincts crying out for nourishment. Slowly, I managed to reassert myself, but it was still an unsettling sensation. Healing that much had taken a lot out of me. I clearly needed to eat.
Just hungry? After a fall like that, I bet you're bordering on ravenous. It took me a while to properly assess your diet, how often you eat, and the quality of the blood you consume, but after a few weeks I've managed to put it all together. If my estimates are right, that injury should have drained you deeply. Soon, possibly within the hour, that desire to feed is going to overtake your rational human mind. You'll fight back, of course, and though you have proven curiously willful in that regard, you will eventually break. Everyone breaks. When that happens, you'll be no better than a wild animal until the hunger has been sated." There was something about the way she said the word hunger that implied capitalization. She talked about it like a living entity, one that would assert itself over me. It was a dire warning, but as I made my way down the boulders to the rough ground below, I found myself somewhat disappointed. I have to say, I was expecting more from the Blood Council. Trying to turn me into a monster was what my sire did the first time we met. Well, the first time post-turn, anyway. You could at least be more original. There was no laughter from Deborah, not even a knowing smile. She was serious as she watched my movements, aware of every twitch I made. "Is that what you think? That I want you to be a monster?" "No, Fred, nothing could be further from the truth. The point of this lesson isn't to make you into more of a vampire. It's to teach you how to stay human." "That's the one thing I actually seem to be good at." A rustle of movement hit my ear seconds before Deborah slammed her hand into my spine, sending me sailing forward to smash against a tree trunk. It hurt, though it was nothing compared to the pain of the fall. Far worse was the feeling that rippled through me as my body repaired the minor wounds, that same living roar that grew in my stomach and screamed through my veins reappeared. Only this time, it was much stronger. I was starting to see why Deborah talked about the hunger like it was a living thing. "You're good at it in the way a person who has never touched alcohol is exceptional at not getting drunk. You've never felt the desire, Fred. Never had to wrestle with that beast in your belly, the one that demands to be fed. When you were turned, you barely tried to hunt before you decided to buy all your blood, and when that went south, you started using agency avenues. You've never been truly empty before. When you get injured, there's blood close at hand. But this is something you'll have to face one day, whether you want to or not."
"Why?"
I pulled myself up from the ground, brushing the leaves and dirt from my clothes. "In your metaphor, what's wrong with being the person who just doesn't drink? I agree that avoiding this feeling is important, but staying fed seems like the safest way to keep that from ever being an issue." Something old and dangerous flashed in Deborah's eyes as she watched me, something that made me involuntarily take a step back.
"You are so young, so accustomed to this world of yours. Hospitals and blood banks and the agency all there to provide for your needs. This country where parahumans have rights and options like delivered blood isn't even 300 years old. Do you understand? Can you fathom how long that is to someone with my perspective? It's nothing, Fred. Nothing. Barely an afternoon. You think those systems will provide for you indefinitely because you lack the wisdom of experience. The world changes, countries fall, and we persist. You cannot count on conveniences or alliances to provide for you. You can only count on yourself. Some day, sooner or later, you will have to deal with the hunger. Better now, when you have a teacher to guide you and know humans for miles, than in the middle of a crowded city, watching the veins throb in the necks of every passerby." The shiver that went down my spine had nothing to do with the chill of the night air or the lingering pain in my body. Ordinarily, I could have brushed her words aside, but tonight I could see the images she described, the veins and necks in particular, filled with hot, potent blood. I almost gasped at the vision, so badly did part of me want to make it real.
Whether she was wrong or whether she was right about what the future held, I couldn't deny that what Deborah had described was possible. Not aging meant that I had to take a long-term view of things, and with the life I led, there was a very real chance I could end up like this, hurt and lacking blood. Only in normal circumstances, the people nearby wouldn't be older vampires I couldn't hold a candle to. They would be my friends. Or worse, normal humans. If this need, this hunger, was part of me, then understanding it might save someone's life further down the line. Someone whose sole sin would have been trusting a vampire.
Maybe you're right. No, you're definitely right, at least about being able to control myself when the need for blood is so great. But I don't want to... I won't hurt humans to feed myself. Buying blood is one thing, killing is another.
I'm not asking you to kill anyone, Deborah informed me. In fact, I'm not asking you to do anything.
The lesson has already begun.